I'm going to start recording now. You guys can start recording when you wish.
Right, welcome. I am recording.
Welcome everyone to Voices with Rebecca. I'm joined again by my good friends, Paul Van de Clay and Mary Cohen. In a sec, I'll ask them to reintroduce themselves. For those of you who might just be seeing this video de novo, this is actually part two. Maybe there's going to be a part three. I'm kind of enjoying this whole process. it's nice hanging out with these two people. It's very nice. It's very refreshing and renewing. And so in part one, we were discussing the relationship between narrative and what I was calling dialogos. I will only speak for myself. I'll allow Paul and Mary to speak from what they got from part one. One of the things I got from part one is an important realization that there was an equivocation in my work. And so I made a distinction between dialogue and dialogos. And I found that very helpful. And then I think we got into some very interesting and deep ideas about that. And that is going to lead us into a discussion today around proposals around other kinds of knowing. And so with that, I think that was neutral. I'm going to pass things to whoever wants to go first. Either one of you introduce yourself. Perhaps it'd be best if Paul went first, Mary, and then you can introduce yourself and then just go into your introduction.
Sounds good.
Okay.
My name is Paul Van de Clay. I met John when John was doing his Awakening from the Meaning Crisis videos. I was introduced by John to John by someone who had been watching his videos, who had also been watching my videos. I have a YouTube channel. I'm a minister in the Christian Reformed Church of North America. I pastor a small congregation in Sacramento, California. And for the last 3 years, I've been making YouTube videos and having stimulating conversations like these. And it's been, again, one of the most stimulating growth-inducing experiences of my life. And so I'm deeply grateful to both of these individuals because they have both stimulated me and embraced me and helped me grow in some new and, I think, remarkable ways. And so I'm very happy to be here this morning.
And I'm Mary Cohen. And I started off getting involved in this by listening to some videos by Jordan Peterson, which directed me to Paul Van de Clay, and Paul and I had some conversations. And then Paul started talking about John Verbeke, and I started watching all of John Verbeke's stuff, which has been quite a wonderful journey. And so I live in Georgia, and I'm a grandmother. I actually have some grandkids over here that I'm helping with schoolwork today, and they are under strict orders to start no fires and engage in no acts of mayhem while we are having this conversation. So hopefully everything will go well. All right, so John, you want me to kind of take it from here for a few minutes?
Yeah, that's how I understood what your response was. Yeah.
All right, good. All right, so what I want to do here is kind of lay out my thoughts about parabolic knowledge. Now, I had listened with a great deal of interest to John's four P's of knowing, and I felt like something was missing, and I wanted to insert something else, and I was under strict orders that it had to start with a P, which constrained the combinatorially explosive possibilities of what I could say. And so what I want to bounce off of today is two concepts that are kind of interrelated in John's lectures. And I'll probably do a very imperfect job of laying them out, and he can come back afterwards and clean it up. All right. And this is particularly his lectures about brain function as it relates to what's that word you always use? The thing that you want to get to, right? And I can't believe that I'm blanking on the word, but it's the relevance realization.
That's what you forgot of everything that John has.
That's right. That's the thing. We want to get to relevance realization, right? So he's talking about brain function and how it relates to relevance realization. And he goes through these two concepts that are related, and they are self-organizing criticality and small world networks. Right. And I'm going to try and work in deep continuity by the end of this. I hope I can. Okay, so this has to do with the brain function and the fact that our brain is adapted to make optimum use of its limited biological resources. And that involves trade-offs between efficiency and resilience, okay? Mm-hmm. The brain has to do a lot of things, and it could do the things it does with maximum efficiency, but it would be vulnerable to failure because it would have single points of failure that would be very critical for it. Mm-hmm. Or it could do the things it does using a lot of redundancy that is highly resilient, but that would make it less efficient.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, this trade-off between resiliency and efficiency shows up in the way the brain organizes its own neural networks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, there is a science behind the way networks are organized. There's a science between the way the networks are organized. They can be organized with many connections between the nodes and lots of redundancy, so they're very resilient to any point of failure, but then they're less efficient. Or they can be organized with great efficiency and be vulnerable to points of failure and therefore less resilient.
Yep.
So what research into brain organization of neural networks has found is that the brain organizes itself in what are called small world networks.
Yes.
Small world networks provide the optimum balance between resilience and efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it isn't as though the brain just builds a single network and then it's done. The brain is constantly building these networks.
Yes.
All right. And when we say building, it's like, it's not really like we're talking about building a structure. What we're talking about is the way the neurons are firing together.
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we're using the word building, just kind of an analogy. Mm-hmm. All right. So the neurons that are already in the brain, they're not building new ones, are firing in particular patterns. So it's the pattern that's being so-called built, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we call the pattern of the firing a network. And there are billions of them that are being created and dissolved and recreated every second in the brain. All right. Once they reach a certain complexity, they fall away and then they reconfigure.
Yep.
All right. Now, this falling into the disorder and reconfiguring, reorganizing is similar to self-organizing that we see in other natural phenomena. It's called self-organizing criticality because it reaches a level of organization that goes beyond its ability to maintain, and then it falls away and starts over.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So some examples that John has given us are those of a tornado, right? Or you can think of it like you've probably seen little whirlwinds or something that they come up, they whirl around, and then they sort of dissolve, right?
Right.
And then also the way that grains of sand at the bottom of an hourglass will mound up into a conical structure and then collapse, and then they'll do it again. So those are a couple of examples of self-organizing criticality. Now, what I want to do is relate this concept of small world networks and self-organizing criticality to parabolic knowing.
Okay.
By bringing into the discussion some brain research that I found out about that I think is extremely interesting. And now part of the work I'm going to talk about, part of this brain research, John's told me was already part of his sources for his own lectures or his own papers, right? Okay, because we had a discussion about this specific researcher and the specific research. However, the part of it that I'm going to talk about is not the same part of it that John talked about. It's an extension of it. It's something he didn't go into in his lecture specifically. All right. So, but I hope I can bring it all together. And so what I want to do is kind of lay it out in a way that I think people can relate to the progression of the thought.
That was an excellent overview of my argument.
Well done. Oh, I did it right. Good.
I don't have anything to add.
Okay, good. All right. So when we think about the brain and we think about the brain firing, you know, we think about those pictures we've seen of the, you know, of the neurons with the axon and the dendrites and the, all the little connections they have. And then the little, they'll do animations of it and they light up, you know, here and there. Okay. Yeah. So that's what we tend to think about when we think of neurons firing. And of course, what's really in the brain is so packed and so, so completely condensed in terms of its structure that you can never see it if someone actually were to lay out the way it is. You wouldn't look like anything to you because it's so packed, so tight. Mm-hmm. There's billions and billions of neurons. There's all this firing going on all the time. And so one of the original images we have is just this thing that you might think of it like the delta of a river stretching out and then making the connections and going like that. But it's really, if you were to think about the structure and you wanted to think about it in a big way that you could possibly put in your mind, it would be more like a forest, okay? Mm-hmm. So think about a forest only packed with the trees, like one right next to the other, which no forest could ever grow that way, but one right next to the other, and you'd have like small trees and medium-sized trees and tall trees and all their branches all connecting with one another. So you get that kind of image in your mind. You have more of an image of how the structure of the neurons and their connections is in the brain, all right? So, and the firing, it looks like if you were to be able to see it, which of course we can't, but there's models of it. It looks, at first it looks almost like a random thing, okay?
Yeah.
But there have been some very exciting brain research projects that have tried to really understand and model the firing of the neurons and what's going on with the brain. One of the big big projects in this has been something that was in Europe called the Blue Brain Project. Say that three times fast. So the Blue Brain Project, when I first ran across somebody elaborating a little bit about its results, I was pretty suspicious because it was presented in kind of a new agey way. We have found out that you are a hyperdimensional creature and brain research proves it, blah, blah, blah. You know? And I was like, yeah, sure. But they showed some images that I thought, let me go in and actually look at the papers and see if they're saying what these, you know, if there's anything to these images that are being shown. So at first I was still suspicious because it started off with like, we made a model of the brain and look at what we found. And I thought, yeah, it's like, I generated all these random numbers and lo and behold, there's a pattern. You know, so I was pretty suspicious that this was bogus. But as I went further in, I found out that they actually had not just done modeling of the brain structure, but they had actually looked at brains. Now, one of the brains they looked at is that of a roundworm, which is not much of a brain, but it can still show brain things, and rats, which do have more of a brain. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I thought, okay, there's something to this. So once I got into it and saw what they were finding in the patterns, I thought it was quite exciting. And I thought it really related to parabolic knowledge. All right. And so that's kind of what I want to show is how I think it relates. But first of all, what I want to do, if I can, is kind of show the paper. So I want to share.
I think I have to share screen on my side. Hang on a sec, Mary. I'm not sure, because I'm the original host. There you go. I think that should work for you now.
That I can share a screen? Okay.
Yeah, it should work now.
Okay, so where's the, I'm trying to figure out where's
the green, the green box at the bottom?
See? Share screen, okay, yeah. I see. Okay, so let me see if I can. So what I wanna do is go into this, I think, and go here. Can you, did I just close out what I wanted to close out, what I wanted to see?
All we're getting is your, we're getting your desktop.
Let me do this. I can get it right here because I was just in it. And
zooming. Be careful what you open up, Mary. You
came across this was by taking these, they recorded this firing of these neurons, mm-hmm. right? And then after they recorded them, they applied a particular geometry to them, mm-hmm. and or they applied a particular algebra to them, a topological mm-hmm. algebra.
Yeah.
And I'm looking for the image that shows the actual forms that they found. Okay, I think this might be it here. Okay. Is this it? Okay, this is getting close to it. So you see that when they applied the geometry, or when they applied the algebraic topology to the firing, they began to find these geometric shapes mm-hmm. that are part of the structure that they could not see. Let me see if it's in this one. I had a particular image that was in here that was so good, and now I cannot seem to locate it. It was, I'm going to do one more quick search here in my history to see if I could find.
And you can search in the document for figure, and that'll take you through the various figures.
All right. So if you look at the way my image of you guys is flashing. I hope it's not doing that to you. Okay, so this is what they located when they went, or what they discovered. When they applied algebraic topology to the firing of the neurons, they discovered that as the neural network was being built, it starts with a simple geometry mm-hmm. and builds up into these particular geometries that you see here. Mm-hmm. And these are called hyperdimensional.
Yeah.
Hyperdimensional polyhedrons, I think is what they're called, right? Mm-hmm. They're not anything that you ever see. Like if you ever walk out in the world, you never see these things, all right? Prior to them finding these things, I guess, in the brain by applying this algebraic topology to the firing of the neurons, I don't think these things were ever seen in a natural thing. They were simply constructions of mathematics, right?
Yeah, because they exist in multidimensional space.
Right.
That's why they're called hyperdimensional.
Right. So this is so the small world networks that the neurons are building mm-hmm. are actually built from these hyperdimensional polyhedrons. Mm-hmm. That's like if you were able to see them, which of course we can't, and of course they're not stable. As soon as they get, you know, to a certain number of dimensions, I think 11 is the highest one that they had, that they were able to find, they fall away and then they're rebuilt, right?
Yep.
So one of the scientists said, it's as though the brain is building these elaborate sandcastles and then they're washing away over and over and over again, constantly.
Yeah.
All right. So when I saw this, now I'm gonna stop sharing this and go back.
Okay. Yeah.
So we all kind of get the picture.
Picture, literally.
All right. So when I saw that, I was really excited because I thought, this relates to parabolic knowing. And now I want to say how it is that I think that works. All right. So I could have called parabolic knowledge analogical, mm-hmm. right? Because that's really what I was thinking about, was analogical. But like I said, I was forced to use a P, so parabolic was the closest one that I could make the connection to. But some of the guys on your is it a Discord you have?
I wondered why you didn't call it like poetical knowledge, because that's closer to metaphor and analogy, and it starts with a P.
Yeah, because I was that's true, but I was going for something that was more precise. Mm. I was going for a very precise logical construction that I felt would collapse the combinatorially explosive possibility space. And I would say poetic knowledge would do the opposite, right? Because it would open up, it would be opening up interpretation. It would be more, and I was looking for something that would bring things to
So what you're trying to emphasize, I won't interrupt you. I just want to make sure I'm understanding.
Go ahead.
That what you want to emphasize in the terminology isn't so much that it's like a parable. You want to get the idea, because the problem I have with parables is they do open up interpretations. That's what the history of parables have shown. You instead want to emphasize that the interpretation is getting sort of locked down in a very powerful way. Am I understanding you correctly?
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. All right.
So that was one of my misunderstandings, by the way, about the word parabolic, because it seemed to me like parables go the other way. And so,
yeah, but my idea of parabolic is that laying side by side of two things, not how many things can I lay side by side, but that there's the one-to-one kind of thing. So now, then we got into the whole question of metaphor, and that was another rabbit trail, okay? Because I want to talk about analogy, but what you did is you did talk about analogy in one of your videos, all right? And yep. Is the work of, what was it, Gertner?
Deidre Gettner. She's considered to have sort of the best theory of analogy around.
Okay, but except that I'm not happy with her description of analogy or what she calls an analogy, because I think she packs a whole bunch of different levels on it. Well, she's going into metaphor, that's why. Whereas the analogy, I would call something very strict. So it would be like this, okay? Okay, let me talk about what she said first and why I don't like it. So
you're becoming quite the cognitive scientist. This is very pleasurable for me.
Okay, so what I don't like about what she said was that it doesn't follow the logic of an analogy, in at least this is the one that you used with her. So the example that you used in your video that came from her was the one where there's an automobile accident and a car collides with a truck, all right? And somebody expresses it as the woman hit the man.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Okay, so like the woman hit the man is used as like I would call that a figure of speech. The woman hit the man.
I just want to be clear. I don't want to misrepresent Gettner. Gettner wasn't using that as an example of an analogy. She was just using that as an example of what higher order relations look like. It's not intended to be a model of an analogy. So
that's what I thought. I thought that's a higher order thing than what I'm focusing on. Because what I want to focus on is the construction A is to B as Y is to Z. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that was the example that I gave when I was doing my video about parabolic knowledge was the example of, for example, if I say, you know, fish is to fin, bird is to wing as instantly as fish is to blank, fish is to fin, right? Or you could even do bird is to wing as blank is to fin and instantly it's fish. So it's like, this is the kind of construction that I'm talking about, this very precise kind of construction like that. All right.
Just to defend Gettner, doesn't she give an example like that?
She might, but I haven't read her. I'm just going kind of like by what you was right. in your lecture.
No, but what I'm saying is I gave another example that was like that. I'm just very careful to represent people, because she says, you know, the solar system onto the atom, the sun is to the planets as the nucleus is to the electrons, right?
I just
want to be fair to her, because she's not here to defend herself.
Oh, right. And I'm not, I haven't read her and I'm sure she's wonderful. It's just that I'm talking about the precise example that the example that you were using is not what the kind of thing that I want to talk about in terms of this analogy. When I'm talking about the parabolic knowing, okay. I want to deal with this sort of this precise thing. The A is to B as Y is to Z construction. Okay. All right. Okay. So, but this is, you know, I mean, this sort of thing, like we use an analogy test with children all the time and stuff like that. Like, you know, dog is to doghouse as car is to garage, right? That sort of thing. All right. Now, what I want to do is I want to talk about that in terms of geometry. All right. And this is kind of like saying, what was my thinking about how I thought what the brain was doing was related to the parabolic knowledge. So I want to draw something. All right. So I have a little tiny whiteboard.
Oh, so you don't need to share screen then?
No. Because okay. That is, I'll tell you what, this technology stuff just messes with me big time. So I can't even get that cap on the marker. All right. So I gotta look at what I'm doing so I can hold this so that you guys can see.
Mary, do you have black? A black marker?
I have dark blue.
Okay. Dark blue. Black is usually best. I learned that when I was doing Awakening from the Meaning Crisis.
Oh, really? I don't think yeah. I don't think I have a black one. All right. I'm just going to draw. I'm drawing a triangle. So I'm going to then hold it up so you can see it. All right. So I drew a triangle.
Yep.
All right. Yep. Now I'm going to do something that, you know, kids do all the time when they're doodling. You probably did it when you were a kid, right? You draw a triangle. Then you do this, right? Right. Okay. See what I did?
Yep.
Now, okay. So when you're a kid and you're doodling like this, what do? And then you're going to fill up all the triangles, right? Mm-hmm. All right. So what I'm going to say here is that this here, this is already an analogy. All right. So now in geometry, we'd call this a flip, right? It's similar because it's the same shape, but different size. So it's similar mm-hmm. geometric shape. But it's flipped, right? Because the point is down here, and up here, the point yeah. is there, right? You got that, right? Okay, yeah. But it's an analogy because look, so if I can write with this thing, it's kind of thick. Well, I'll just point at it. So we can go A is to B as Y is to Z.
Sure.
You could do that with all the sides.
Yeah.
Right? And if I was to fill it up with a whole bunch of little triangles, which kids like to do that kind of doodle, right? Mm-hmm. I would be doing that constantly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. But they're all analogies. Mm-hmm. Every time that a new one is constructed, it's an analogy with the one that was there before. Okay. All right. Now, I want to talk about that with dimensions. So this is, you can see this, right? Mm-hmm. This is a, this is a tetrahedron. Yeah, three looks sides. Like it. Yeah. It's three, it's a triangular pyramid, right? Yeah. Okay. So now let's say that you were to take this and you wanted to add dimensions, more dimensions. This is three dimensions. It doesn't have a bottom though. I lost the bottom. But anyway, it's from my kids, you know, geometry instruction stuff. All right, now, so let's say you were going to add dimensions to this. All right, you could take each one of these sides and you could multiply them out to make them part of something shaped like this, and it would keep going, right? Mm-hmm. And you could add dimensions. If this was big, you could add the dimensions from the inside, right? You could go down. You could do it. You could make, you know, like a model of something that was multidimensional, right? Sure. But each time you're doing it, you're doing that same logical thing. You're mm-hmm. doing an A is to B as Y is to Z kind of thing, using the points, using the lines, the edges, and using the planes, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So when I saw that thing, that geometric thing that they found in the brain, I thought, okay, that's what. Now I want to be careful here because I don't want to fall into saying that the planets are doing calculus, which I know you would hit on right away. But I'm not saying that the brain is doing that as a, you know, that the brain is thinking, okay, I have to build this next thing. So I'm doing this A is to B as Y is to Z thing inside, right? What I'm saying is that is what is happening. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. Even though I'm not attributing to the brain a self-knowledge of its own geometry. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. So that is why I think that when I talked about the parabolic knowledge constraining the possibility space, the same thing's going on inside of the brain with regard to these neural networks.
Sure.
Because that A is to B as Y is to Z, thing that the brain has to do, that function that the brain has to do to create the neural networks, collapses inside of the brain itself, the possibility space, because it's got these billions and billions of neural networks and connections it can make. But of course, it's trying to get to that small world network very efficiently. And I'm saying that this is how
Okay, go ahead.
This relates to how it is doing it. So it's a parabolic function or an analogic function, just even with regard to this structure that's going on in the brain. Am I making sense?
Well, sure. I mean, I have questions, okay. but that's why we're here.
So that logic that's going on in the brain collapses the combinatorially explosive nature of how many possibilities there are for the neural connections.
Well, I want to wait till you're done, Mary, before.
Okay. So now I have just a couple more things to say. So I feel like, or I think that this has implications for that you want to take your logic stuff all the way down into the chain of being, into the chain of life, right? So that deep continuity.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So I thought about sponges, right?
Yeah.
So sponges, you know, you can take a sponge and put it through a sieve, right?
Yep.
And it'll reorganize itself.
Mm-hmm.
It self-organizes.
Yep.
But it has three layers of cells. It has three different kinds of cells, which have to be placed into a certain configuration of three layers. Otherwise, the sponge doesn't work. So you put the sponge through a sieve, it reorganizes itself into smaller sponges. But all of those little sponges are organized the same way in terms of the layers of cells.
Yep.
And they have to be, otherwise it's not going to function.
Right.
All right. So you've made the criticality for it. Putting it through a sieve, it hasn't dissolved itself, but when you dissolve it, it'll come back as sponges and it'll organize itself, and it'll still be that A is to B as Y is to Z organization matching what it had before you dissolved it.
Sure.
All right. And then I wanted to think about movement. I wanted to bring the idea of movement in here. So they have found that there are these cells, they call them place cells in the hypothalamus.
Yeah, this is somewhat controversial, but go ahead.
Okay, well, I'm gonna throw it in here anyway, just because I find it intriguing.
Well, it gets controversial when there are some people who make the claim that we have you might find this funny, Mary, we have a grandmother cell, a cell that fires just when our grandmother is present, which I regard as a ridiculous proposal. So there's a lot of variation on that.
Okay, well, the one I'm talking about is just that has to do with location.
Yeah.
So like if you put, I guess I've done these experiments with rats, you put the rat in a particular place and they can map like these, and the hypothalamus is like a simpler part of the brain, right? I guess, or a more old part of the brain or whatever.
It's older. I wouldn't say it's necessarily simpler, but older is probably better.
Yeah. Probably better. And so you put the rat in a particular location and as it maps the territory that you put it in, certain neurons will fire in the hypothalamus,
right,
that they call place neurons. They say that the animal is mapping its territory.
Yeah.
Then you take the rat out and you put another rat in there. And when the first rat is watching the second rat go to the same places, the same neurons will fire.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's one of those A is to B as Y is to Z situations, because the rat, it's as though the rat is saying, and I know the rat's not saying, and I'm not attributing logic to the rat. It's as though the rat is able to say, I am to that place as this other rat is to that place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's making an analogy.
Mm-hmm.
I think this would also be involved if you want to get to real simple critters like the nematodes, roundworms, nematodes. We call them nematots around here because we're very fond of soil biology. So they're little nematodes that are, you know, they have to move. Anything that has to move to maintain the integrity of its movement is, it's, as it goes to a new place, it's still that same logical function of A is to B as Y is to Z, to move its body. I think that becomes very complicated, but it's still the same function when we talk about like animals that, like for example, a starfish, you cut off an arm, it grows a new one. Mm-hmm. Or when you deal with the bilateral symmetry of many creatures, right? You've got that same A is to B as B is to C function, but you got flip. Okay, I'm done.
Okay, well, there's a lot to respond to on that. I'll try and be as careful. First of all, congratulations, and I mean that sincerely. That was really good cognitive science. And if I'm making everybody do more cognitive science, then I've really succeeded in my ultimate secret agenda. So, which is not so secret, right? So that's very good. And I also want to commend, and again, I mean this sincerely, you guys taking seriously that cutting edge cognitive science is saying things that we should, that even people who are within a religious framework should be paying attention to. And I think that's a very significant recognition, and I want to acknowledge that. I think that's important. It may be that actually those two points I just made are the most important things of this whole dialogue, but that doesn't mean I'm going to avoid the topic. But I want to upfront and say I think that's really, to me, that seems very important what you guys are doing, and I want to express appreciation for that. That's important. So I want to go first to recursivity, because what you're actually describing is called recursivity. It's scale invariance. So a system is recursive as it does the kind of thing you said. If it feeds back on itself, and when it's scale invariant recursive, it feeds back on itself and you see the same patterns. They're not totally identical, right? Because, right, you're getting more triangles, for example, as you go up the dimensionality, et cetera. But that's the thing about scale invariance is you're not claiming that the two things are logically identical. You're claiming that there are shared principles of organization all the way through, right? Because if they were shared, there'd be no point in doing it, right? Sorry, if they were identical, there'd be no point in doing it. Just stay down here, right? So recursivity is, again, that, and Mary, I totally agree. Recursivity and where we can find scale invariance is how we do deep continuity as something different from reduction, right? Or different from my conversation with JP, right? Different from panpsychism, because panpsychism says, no, it's consciousness all the way down. Whereas deep continuity says, no, right? There's principles of consciousness that are continuous with non-conscious processes, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not trying to pull a fast one on JP. He knows I care about him. He knows I respect his position. I'm just trying to use a past history you guys are familiar with to make clear the distinction. Okay, and so what I want to say then is I want to zero in on two or three points. The first one I want to zero in on is the language of collapse, because my understanding of this literature is that it's only because the brain is doing self-organizing criticality and small world network formation is that's why it forms these multidimensional complexities. So it's because the brain is doing SOC and SOC, self-organizing criticality, and small world network formation that it does this complexification. And that's also why it collapses, as you said, and builds back up, the whole thing. So the thing is, that's how it's scale invariant. The whole thing is doing SOC, and then all the parts are doing SOC, right? It's scale invariant all the way through. The whole thing is a small world network, and it's made out of smaller small world networks recursively. Is that okay? Because that's how I read this literature.
Yeah.
So what that means is that SOC and small world networks cause this complexity, right? So it's a result of them. Is that okay?
It's a cause and a result.
It's recursive, but the thing is,
so it's,
we're not talking about stages. We're talking about types of entities. The complex polyhedral multidimensional things are built. They're made by SOC and small world network formation. Okay. Now, you've agreed, at least in this argument, although I think you seem to agree more deeply, and again, very, very gratifying to me, that small world network formation and SOC are doing RR. They're doing relevance realization.
That's kind of what I'm thinking, that it's related. Yeah. Well, I said that right at the beginning. It's related to the relevance realization.
Right. So the system is basically doing relevance realization, and then that's causing this complexification, right?
System is doing relevance realization.
So if I had a system and it wasn't
if
it wasn't structured to pursue efficiency and resiliency, it wouldn't build these complex things, right?
Right.
Okay. So what that means to me then is, I don't think it's right to say the complexification is collapsing, or it's the other way around. It's because the system is capable of doing really sophisticated relevance realization that it produces this.
All right. I think we're in like a chicken and egg problem here.
Well, not really, because like I said, you did agree with me that if I don't have a system constrained to do SOC and small world network, it's not going to go into this hyperdimensionality thing. You're not going to see that.
Right.
Okay, so that's a causal dependence, right?
Okay.
So doing this is causally dependent on relevance realization.
Okay.
Right.
Which means what you're saying, let me see if I can restate.
Yeah.
So in a way, if you take it down to the triangle that I drew.
Yeah.
So you would say at the very simplest level, we're already starting with a relevance realization right there to start to build.
Yeah. So in the analogy, it would be the ability to make a triangle and then map other triangles around to it and then map. Right. That's already doing it. And so what I'm saying is, And this is how I think about this a lot, because I try to be very careful, because I totally agree with the recursivity. Mm-hmm. I'm not denying that. But what I want to say is you can't ultimately explain the complex. You can't use the complexity to explain how relevance realization occurs, because it ultimately presupposes relevance realization in its construction.
Right. And that's exactly what I wanted to say. Okay. So maybe what you're calling relevance realization is what I'm calling the parabolic not knowing, or yeah, what I'm calling, you know, in when I was doing this, I just said the analogy. The A is to B as Y is to Z construction.
Yes.
So I want to really constrain that real narrowly down to that and not get into like poetry and
And I totally agree. Let's stay there. You and I are in complete agreement. Let's stay at something that we can keep really sort of basic and fundamental. I agree.
Right. So, all right. So I'm going, okay. So we're at the geometries that are being found in the brain is the construction of the small world network doing self-organizing criticality.
Yeah.
Now we're at the point where we were talking about why it collapses, or why it, you said you didn't like collapse.
The point I was objecting to was the idea that the system is collapsing the combinatorial explosive space.
Oh, like that part. Okay.
I think the causal arrow goes the other way around. It's precisely because it can do recursive relevance realization that it avoids combinatorial explosion in the construction of this complexity.
Because
the brain's task is to complexify itself in a way that tracks the relevant complexity in the world. Yes.
And that was what I was trying to get at. I was trying to get that whatever this thing is that the little child does, when the child says, you know, is putting the silverware on the table, and puts the knife down and says, daddy, puts the fork down and says, mommy, and then puts the spoon down and says, baby, that thing that the child is doing is the same thing as when the brain is going from building that first, going from the simplest or simplest, however they say that, you know, and adding the next structure of the geometry to that neural network. because she's doing A is to be as B is to C with the daddy mommy baby.
Okay. So that's what I would want to say.
It's the same function.
Right. But so what I'm saying is it's recursive relevance realization.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I see is recursive relevance realization is always mapping. You said, for example, movement. So I do the form and I have to map that into sparring. And then I have to map that into actually fighting on the street, God forbid. And sorry, I didn't mean that sacrilegiously. I mean, literally, I don't want that to happen, right? Right. Even when you win a fight, it takes a piece of your soul away, right? So there's mapping there. Obviously, there's mapping within perspectival knowing. You did this. I take on your perspective. You take on mine, right? And there again, it's your perspective, but it's not really your perspective, right? I'm doing this A and not A at the same time. Same thing with the fork for the child. She doesn't really think that's her mom. It's her mom and it's not her mom, because she wouldn't be happy if you got rid of her mom and just gave her fork. She would go, oh, I still got mom, right? So it's A and not A, right? And that's the thing, right? And so the point, what I'm trying to get at is, isn't that just a feat? I mean, so let me be really careful here. And I think you're in agreement with me. I think, so what we can do, and this is part of the argument I made, we can measure self-organizing criticality and we can measure general intelligence. And one of the piece of evidence for this whole theory is measuring this, it predicts this. It's highly correlated together, right? So what we're measuring is intelligence. And it seems to me that intelligence is the capacity to do relevance realization in which I transfer relations from one situation to another. That's problem solving. And then if that's the case, I think it's a category mistake to call that a new kind of knowing, because it's presupposed in your own examples by all kinds of knowing. It's you're pointing to intelligence rather than a kind of knowing. And I think that's a good thing. And if you say to me, do we know by being intelligent or activating our intelligence? Of course. But I don't think that's a separate kind of knowing. I think this is exactly right. I'm sorry, I'm not trying to do a jujitsu move on you.
No, I'm fine.
This is more fundamental. I think you're pointing to something fundamental. And I do think it's important. I think the idea that we're doing recursive relevance realization and mapping, you even used mapping when you did the rats, right?
Right.
Mapping across the main, that is knowledge. That's what it is to know. I can't think of an instance of knowing where these things would be absent.
Right? Okay.
And therefore, it's not going to be a specific kind of knowing.
Okay. So the point at which I was having a bit of trouble with what you were saying in your lectures had to do with this. When you presented that, the concept of the combinatorially explosive nature of the possibility space.
Yes.
All right. And then the way that we come to any kind of conclusion, which we have to do constantly, yeah. Right? It's going on in our brain all the time, millions of times a second, right?
Yep.
That it's happening.
Yep.
That. When I'll give the example, which comes from this woman researcher talking about the, and you use this example, talking about the solar system and the atom, right?
That's Deirdre Gentner. Okay. That's your favorite example.
So when you were talking about it, you talked about how does the conclusion happen?
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about, well, there's, you know, and you started to go through the whole combinatorially explosive nature of all of the differences and similarities between the atoms and the solar system, right? And the question of how did the person who came up with that illustration come up with that illustration?
Yep.
And you talked about, you know, it would be impossible to search the possibility space.
Well, yeah,
if you come to the right, and it's always impossible to search the possibility space for anything, because there's always a combinatorial explosive number of possibilities of similarity and differences between any two things.
Yeah, maybe it'd be helpful to just do a quick things for people who are watching, right? So some of the criticism, not made by me, I mean, I've published these criticisms, but made by many people about Gentner's theory is, well, here's my data on the atom. What do I look for in all of my possible, all of my memory? That requires recursive relevance realization. Because what I have to be doing is doing this. I have to be sort of, because if I have exactly the structure in order to find the solar system, then I don't need to consider the solar system because I have the full structure. So you have to do this recursive relevance realization, kind of a moving back and forth like that. Or when in order to do it, out of all the levels at which I could describe the solar system, I have to zero in on the right one. I have to zero in on the right properties. I don't look to what corresponds in the atom to the color of the sun. And on the third planet, there's life. On the third electron, is there life? So you can see there's combinatorial explosion all over the place. This is why when we try to give computers the ability to map, we hit the frame problem. We hit combinatorial explosion. Right. So if you were to tell an AI person, well, you know how you give it intelligence, give it the ability to do analogy. They're going to look at you like, of course, but that's exactly the problem, right? That's exactly the problem.
Right. I have no interest in assisting AI. But here is what I thought about that. So let me just say what I think about that. And we're going to have to let Paul get a word in edgewise here at some point.
Yeah.
Here's what I was thinking.
I agree.
The whole thing with the solar system and the atom is that let's say the scientist came to the point at which he started to think of the electrons as in some way circling or orbiting the nucleus. The moment that he had a recognition of this, of being able to frame it in that way, he's immediately constrained down to a very small number of possibilities. Because if I say to you, hey, I've got something that, you know, we've got a center and then we've got something circling in the on the outer perimeter, what would be an example of that? I mean, the list of possibilities is going to go, well, let me see, is it a clock, you know, with the hands going around? Is it like an axle and the rim of a wheel? Or, you know, solar system, planets going around the sun. I mean, really, your number of things that you got to kind of mentally pass through to see that relationship is very tiny.
Right.
And it's the same thing with the bird is to wing as fish is to fin. Once I say to you, bird is to wing as fish is to, you know, what are your possibilities? They're very constrained.
Yeah, I agree. But then there's a mystery. The mystery is, how does the original insight occur? And it can't be because of the analogy, because you're saying the analogy follows from the initial insight.
Because I think it's a relationship insight, not a thing insight.
I think all insights are pretty much relationship insights. I don't quite know what that means, what you just said.
Well, what I mean is that
when
I say bird is to wing as fish is to fin, the focus is not the thing bird or even the thing wing. The focus instantly goes to, and then it begins, now I'm going to throw out another P as I talked about this with Mark and Manuel. And I said, if I throw this in, John's going to say she's promiscuously multiplying these P's, but it's prepositional. It's prepositional because it's the on, it's the in, it's the of, it's the to, it's that, right?
It's relational.
Prepositional. And prepositions, this was a point I made when I was talking to Mark and Manuel, prepositions are not in the propositional space. Proposition, and this is one thing that you learn from teaching a child grammar. When you're teaching them how to diagram a sentence, you would know that I'd be a fan of diagramming sentences, right? When you're teaching them how to diagram a sentence, you teach them first all the prepositions. Cross those prepositional phrases out of the sentence. Then you can easily find the the subject of the sentence and the verb, because the subject and the verb, neither the subject of the sentence nor the verb in the sentence are the predicate. Neither of them are going to be in the prepositions, prepositional phrases. So it's...
I thought you meant propositional at the end. But
well, propositions are made. No, they're not going to be in. What I'm saying is that a proposition is a subject and a verb, or, you know, a subject and a verb makes a proposition together, but the prepositions are not in that.
Okay. Well, I sort of disagree with that.
Okay, go. Tell me.
Because first of all, wing to bird is not a preposition. It's a part whole relationship. It's a functional relationship. And we don't have a preposition for that, which is one of the difficulties we have. Secondly, I mean, propositions contain all kinds of functional words, right, that bind things together. Logic is actually about, it's why it's called formal logic. It's about all the binding relations, like and but and or and some and in, like it's all of those, right? And so if you take those out of a proposition, you don't have a proposition. Those are all the syntax markers, right? And if what you're saying is that what you want to point to is the brain maps relations by using prepositions and other relational markers. Notice how a lot of the times we use prepositions as sort of stand-in metaphors when we're trying to find the relational term, like a structural functional relationship or a cause whole. If you read the Neoplatonists, they talk about the effect being in the cause because they're trying to figure out the relation, things like that. So again, isn't it the case that all knowing is mapping relations? I can't see what a kind of knowing would be again, right? I'm not mapping the actual, I'm not taking the movement I'm doing in my room and trying to replicate it when I'm fighting. I'm saying, as my arm was towards my television and my knee was towards my wall, now I need my arm to be towards his face and my knee towards his leg. I'm mapping relations. That's what you're doing. In fact, that's part of the knack about trying to get people to understand this. Like you tell them, don't practice in just one room because then you won't be able to transfer it. You'll be looking from this distance from my hand and the TV. No, don't do that. Pick up the relation and how can you map it, right? All of this, I think, is every kind of knowing involves this kind of process.
Well, what I want to say about that, let's go back to the bird and the wing. What I want to say about that is the function is, the functional relationship is not what makes us instantly go to bird and thin. It's not the functional relationship.
Actually, there's good evidence it is. That's the whole work of Mary Douglas. Right? People look for structural functional relationships between the morphology of the animal, the way they move around, and the environment that they're in. That's what they're constantly looking for.
Okay. What about dog is to doghouse as dog is to doghouse as car is to
garage. Yeah.
Yes,
that's a functional relationship, right?
But it's the, I think it's the in. It's the inness, if I could do that to the word in of it, that is the, it's that inness. Okay. So if you go back to the geometry thing, there's not a structural functional relationship.
Yeah, there is.
That triangle and that, there's just the,
there is a structural, there's a structure, which is a triangle, and there's the function of recursivity. It's a structural functional relationship. You see, and the thing is, and your color example is a good example because it's just straight mapping of function, right? Mapping of relation.
Mapping of function is very interesting in the knife, fork, spoon.
Yeah.
because the, now I've found this whole thing fascinating and instructive, but maybe the preacher of me wants to kind of pull back and say, okay, why are we talking about this stuff?
Although I do think I do think that Mary was making an important point about trying to keep this, at least initially, at a very, very basic and fundamental.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was, and I so I wanted to play just in that field with Mary because I thought that was being fair to her.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think I thought it was all wonderful. And so let me first say that Mary, I'm tremendously impressed at how you digested, you know, so much of John's stuff into this and then went out and fed on some other things. That was your introduction was really quite amazing. I thought it was clear and concise and powerful. Now, again, it's a little, I know this because I've listened to John's stuff and we've been in this conversation, and this is where we get into the question, okay, what are we doing here? And why is the religious, non-religious relation here relevant? Why do we have interest in this? What's with all the peas? I really loved the way that this kind of laid out the deep mapping of the world and made it quite intelligible to me in terms of, you know, if what we're doing deep inside is all of this modeling and unmodeling, you can see that in, you know, you can, if you, you know, I've had 5 children. Mary has been a close watcher of children. Both Mary and I have homeschooled, which is a, like so many interesting things in this world, homeschooling is such a deeply rewarding thing to do because, you know, I'm being a pastor, I'm homeschooling, yeah. I'm watching my children. So you get a chance, instead of going off to work each day and letting mom be with the kids or even outsourcing this to childcare or schooling, you get to watch stuff with kids and you sort of watch them develop right from the beginning. And we don't even realize we're watching because so much of this, and I really love the way this conversation has unfolded, all of this mapping gets into us. And I've been talking a lot lately in my videos about first drafts, because it strikes me as a pastor, you sit down with a rather unhappy couple that have just stood up in front of church and pledged their undying love. And now a few years later, they're at each other's throats. And it's like, well, what happened here? And so you begin to realize that there was a, and okay, well, they both have the maps of their parents' relationships and they stand as opposed to it. So we have this question about how the world works. And I love John's pursuit of saying, let's get this down into natural, and I'll try to speak Canadian here, processes. let's get down into natural processes here, because I like that actually better than processes. I think processes is a little more elegant. There's another level of relationality I just mapped. So let's get this down into processes, which as you know, C.S. Lewis's miracles, they go on their own. And we see this with human beings. And actually winding all the way through this, and John, you mentioning JP and his panpsychism, which when I first heard it, I thought, you know, oh gosh, where's my cell phone stand? That is no consciousness. But I have a better, deeper understanding of why people turn to that option in terms of it's almost an alternative to John, your relevance realization, which is this, you know, okay. How do we do this? And then, you know, Mary, what you've all laid out just gives me a vision of, okay, we're all absorbing this first draft. What does that mean? That we're all just absorbing this world around us and mapping it to an amazing degree with amazing efficiency in our minds. And, you know, I just listening to both of you gives me in some ways a what one might call a religious experience, because I am in this moment, I'll put it in religious terms because those are the terms, of course, I've been formed by, you know, just a praise of the glory of God at the manifest beauty and intricacy. And I don't find the natural perspective of things going on their own as threatening to this at all, because just like with doing science, you begin to see, wow, this is durable. This is pervasive. This is also lavished on, you know, the just and the unjust. This is given liberally to the world, that we're all, we've been given this astounding capacity to map. And I just, the image I have in my mind is just this continual mapping, and that little girl sitting with the play setting and the parents somehow seeing daddy is to knife and mommy is to fork and I am the spoon. That this mapping is just going on constantly, and we're always looking for relationships. We're always, and so mentally, I love this, what, you know, one of the things Jordan Peterson, one of his great lines was, you know, we have ideas so that our ideas can die instead of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so we're, and when I think of this relevance realization process, I think of all of this, all of these maps that we have in our minds, and we're constantly checking them. We're constantly checking them. And so you guys have just given me this vision of what the world works and how relationality works. And I think in some of what we're doing is we're testing. So John gave us the four P's when he came down from the mountain, awakening from the meaning crisis.
Oh,
and he gave us the four
like
P's.
That. I did not come down from
it. It was wonderful. But you giving us the four P's now, you know, the propositional, well, what are we talking about? The perspectival, the participatory, the procedural, and Mary comes in with the parabolic, and I've been thinking about the proverbial. But even there, we're testing, we're mapping and we're using P's. Okay. And we're mapping them. And I just think it's an amazing vision. I guess maybe the one thing I would want to throw onto this is, when I listen to both of you and I think about the religious valence and the tensions we have in religious communities about physis, as Lewis calls it, or natura, of things going on their own. I mean, why is the universe so alive to us? A thing that comes into my mind in my own mapping, again, goes back to Jordan Peterson's conversation with Sam Harris, because that, of course, enlivens this interesting religious, non-religious, anti-religious network. Mm. Where, I mean, Peterson, what he wanted to keep pushing on Harris was, look, we don't see the world as disembodied consciousness things.
No,
we are in the midst of this vast process. And when I listen to both of you talk, and I think about this, I actually think about a lot of the conversations going around with respect to intelligent design. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because when I am enthralled, when I am just excited by the vision that both of you have really laid out very nicely. I don't see a lot of disagreement between the two of you in this thing. And I see this capacity that we have of mapping. And okay, so how is the knowing and the mapping and then the desiring, the seeing and the mapping and the desiring? I mean, how do all of these things work? And, you know, we have eyes to know and ears and skin to touch. I mean, we recognize ourselves as so far down the process and the capacity that you just see us having been formed. And I just see us in many ways as these astounding creatures that are heirs of, unbelievable sacrifice and care, and that we, to this point, you know, we come from our mothers and we're ready to map, and we're mapping without knowing it. And so that's just the vision that I have of listening to you talk. And I've, you know, it's just been a privilege to sit here and watch both of you just, you know, I in my language would be watch both of you tell of the glory of God. And I don't mean that offensively, John.
No, you're not offending me. You're not offending me at all.
Because that's what I see in this process, that here we are at this point, fortunate recipients of astounding capacity that, And that goes all the way down to we're mapping these tiny little relationships and we're trying them out in the world. And it just makes the world a living, beautiful, glorious place. So that's what I got in this. And I'm just deeply grateful for what you two have given us.
Well, thank you. I wasn't offended.
Okay.
In fact, the idea that we complexify in order to, and we complexify in an evolving way so that our complexification more and more conforms to the complexity of the world. Never perfectly, never finally, because it can't, because the world isn't finished, et cetera, et cetera. And that deep conformity, and then the deep participatory knowing, that deep conformity means there are deep affordances between intelligence and the intelligibility of the world. And that to me is the core of the Neoplatonic vision. And that's what I've been trying to, like what, you know, Jonathan Pageau was talking about. There's something about the way the world complexifies that's deeply analogous. And this is what maybe Mary's trying to point to the way our cognition is evolving. And if Mary, I'll let you speak, but if what Mary wants to say is that there's this deep analogy, I don't even know if that's the right word, because the Neoplatonists want to push it and they want to talk about conformity. Ultimately, because you want a relationship that allows for an at-one-ment and not just a mapping eventually. I don't want to say too much. I'm trying to make space for Mary without putting words into her mouth. But if you're asking, do I think that is a beatific vision? Well, I definitely do. And I am motivated by that vision. This is what I'm trying to articulate this vision with this weird metaphysics of emergence and emanation, and trying to articulate and then the participatory knowing is the ongoing dynamical conformity that can move up and down the emergence and emanation. I would call it Platonic Eros, no offense, hopefully, right? That motivates me deeply and profoundly. That's why I care about it. I mean, I don't care about it just because I'm a scientist with a theory. And I hope this matters again. I hope that my caring about it in this way makes me open and available to you guys in a responsive and responsible manner. Because I do care about it beyond just here's the academic with his scientific theory. I think there's something more encompassing here. Mary sent me a very wonderful email about that. And I thank her for doing that.
We all have our our things that are tugging at our heart.
Yes.
You know? And for you, you know, seeing people in a meaning crisis, this tugs at your heart. For me, my piece of this, and when you started talking about the deep continuity, that was very resonant with me.
Yeah.
Because for me, my piece of this is, are feeling that we're just getting so disconnected from the natural world in every way, and that is damaging us. Like when my daughter when my daughter talks to me about that, so one of my daughters came up with the nematodes thing. It's like, you know, if we put something on the yard, she goes, "How's that going to affect the little nematodes?" It's like we're being conscious of the soil biology. You know, we're feeding, if I say I'm feeding the soil, I'm feeding life that lives in the soil.
Yeah, that's
going to turn around and feed me. And so this sense of being connected in this, to the world in this natural way is to me so important. And this is the thing, it's like, in a way, I feel like I'm at war with the AI, you know, or the robot aficionados and all of that. It's like, it's because, and you said this in one of your lectures, it doesn't care.
Yes, that's
right. It's never going to care.
Yes,
that's right. It's not going to care about the nematodes.
No.
The robot doesn't care about the soil ball. It's not going to care. It's not going to care about us. It's not even going to care about itself, to the extent that you could say it even has a self. It's not going to care.
That's right.
How do we get more caring into the world, especially the kind of caring that goes all through the levels of being, you know, to all of the life. And I guess, you know, that's what I want to keep dragging people back to. We had a reading, and we didn't actually read, we had two variant readings that we could have read for the mass this weekend. And my favorite one that I was hoping would be read was not the one that got read. It was another one, but there's a passage in Isaiah that says, why are you spending your money for that which is not food? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I want a sign like 10 feet with letters 10 feet tall in front of every grocery store that's with that scripture on it.
So I think I'm in deep agreement with you about this. And I want to say something here. And I've said it repeatedly, and I'm worried that, and I don't think you two are saying this, but I do hear it. I've tried to argue that the reason why the AI can't care is exactly the same reason as why it doesn't do relevance realization. That's the argument. I keep saying relevance realization is not cold calculation. Relevance realization is caring. It's about, if I find this more relevant than that, I'm caring. And the reason I do that is because I care about information rather than this information, rather than that information. That's what relevance realization is. Relevance realization is about salience. It's about affect. It's about motivation. And the thing is, the reason why I do that is because I'm fundamentally, I'm a being that has to take care of myself. And until we have robots that are autopoetic machines, if you allow me a machine to be used in a very neutral term, autopoetic systems perhaps is a better thing, right? Until they're very much analogous to being living beings, we're not going to give them relevance realization. And that means we're not going to give them true intelligence. And I think what I'm seeing is as we are driven for not always good reasons, I acknowledge that right now, as we're driven towards trying to make artificial general intelligence, AGI, we are more and more driven to trying to make these machines autopoetic, machines that take care of themselves and care about this information rather than that information. So I don't know. I don't know if the corporate and political structures are going to steer AI ultimately in a great direction. But I'll do a scientific and put my neck on the block, because that's what scientists are supposed to do at some point. I predict that if we try to give AGI to a machine, we're going to find that we're going to give it more and more the capacity to care and take care of itself until it starts to look more and more like a living thing and not just a computational thing. I think that's what's coming. One possible variant. We might get quantum computing that does all this stuff for us, and quantum computing doesn't care, right? But that's not the kind of AI that I'm interested in, because that doesn't tell me anything about how minds work.
Well, I want to jump in here, John, on just a little bit of something that you said when you said, you know, and this again maps theologically for me, because you say, you know, I want it to take care of itself. And that, yep, I think in our cultural frame has sort of become one of these truisms that I don't think is yeah. But you're right, because the thing is, you certainly care about yourself. You ought to care about yourself, but at this point, you know, you're a father, you're yes. a teacher. The real question is, well, what exactly is yourself? Because
totally.
and the same with AI. Yeah. Because all the science fiction movies that we worry about are all these AIs caring about themselves at the expense of all of, you know,
well,
us creators here.
No, that's a totally good point. And that's what, insofar as you're trying to make artificial intelligence, I think if we want to make, I don't know if you've ever seen it. I got a video saying we shouldn't be just trying to make systems intelligent, artificially intelligent. Because we have really good evidence that you can be highly intelligent and highly self-deceptive and highly self-destructive. Yeah. We want artificial rationality,
right,
and ultimately artificial wisdom. And then would it even be artificial wisdom? That doesn't sound like it makes sense to me anymore. So I totally agree with that. And so one of the things I do in the arena of the ethics of AI is strenuously argue for stop just trying to make artificial intelligence. You want to make something that, and you know that I mean rationality much bigger than logicality, yep. right? Yep. For me, the relationship, the aspirational relationships I have, and the relationships of caring for others, that they fall under that because I think we're inherently distributed, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So the point I was just making is the paramecium is way different than any computer we have. The paramecium is yeah. because the paramecium is making itself and taking care of itself. So the paramecium cares about sugar and cares about various poisons and doesn't care about a whole bunch of stuff precisely because it's a paramecium, yeah. right? That's the deep continuity. Yeah.
And yet we have the deep continuity and the discontinuity.
Yeah.
Unlike, even the, I make this analogy all the time, the gorilla, the endangered gorilla in the jungles of Congo in the midst of everything going on in this world is not anxious for its survival.
Yeah.
I mean, Mary has lovingly bestowed upon her daughter a care for, and even the naming you took, the nematots. I mean, you make them, and there's the parabolic, there's Mary's parabolic knowing, these tiny little creatures in the soil. And what is the soil? The soil is not just this inorganic matter and semi-mindless things going about, worrying about their own survival. Now we have, a creature who has, in a sense, mapped motherliness onto, these tiny little worms in the soil. And so here again, in terms of mapping, we see, we're a little lower than the angels here. And we're caring, for the beauty of the earth. We're caring for this, caring for the soil, and we're caring for each other, and we're caring for ourselves because we're a part of this. And again, to me, what you two have done this morning is really in some ways connected heaven and earth.
Yeah. I don't think you can be, this is the more ancient version of rational. I don't think you can be rational unless you care about the truth,
yeah.
unless you care about the good, unless you care about the beautiful.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that capacity to care, I can't give it to you.
Yeah.
This is the great Socratic point. I can't teach you to care about the truth because you won't listen to me. You won't believe me, right? Unless you care about the truth, I can't get you to care. Like once you got it, I can help you draw it out. I can deduce it from you, right? That's the original meaning of educate. Yeah. Same thing with caring about the good. Like there's no argument you can give a psychopath that will make them start behaving morally. Because they just don't have that fundamental caring.
Yeah,
totally. And I think that's really fundamental. And if that's what you guys want me to acknowledge and say is central is important, I'm totally in agreement with that. I think, but what I want to understand as a scientist is I want to see how your capacity, which we share with animals, because there's many animals that are highly intelligent, how the capacity for intelligence makes possible is in deep continuity, but not identical with that kind of rationality.
And again, I think the gorilla that is not anxious for his survival is some ways analogous to that, because here we are. I mean, could a gorilla ever, despite all of the intelligence and the language and things, what is it about us that we care for the gorilla in a way that the gorilla can't care for? And then you have the question, well, what on earth is a gorilla? because we care that the gorilla be in nature, even though the gorilla might say, no, I kind of like you providing the housing and the protection and the food resourcing to me. The life of Pi, the point that book made quite early on.
Well, there's a book called Ishmael that does the same thing with the talking gorilla.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I haven't read that book.
That's a good book.
So it's because we're running out of time, I know, but maybe they'll need to be third. So part of me again comes to this and says, okay, what's, because I've listened to Mark. I'm probably going to have him on to hear him a little bit more. I've got to know him a little bit better on the Discord server. What's the problem with John's four P's? And I think John completely knows this. We're trying to improve them. And adding another P isn't necessarily improvement, but there's a question of, okay, perspectival, participatory, procedural. Those certainly for me were a big upgrade from all of the people saying there's proposition and nothing else. Because that's been a problem theologically as well as I'm sure in terms of philosophy outside the church. So
yeah, that was particularly relevant to the meaning crisis. I mean, so there's two things, and there's two ways in which I'm trying to be responsible to that. One is, I think the question, and Greg Enriquez and Christopher Mastropietro and I are going to address it. I've taught a course and done work on the series that's coming out, The Elusive I, The Nature and Function of the Self. We're going to do a series, a dialogical series, like I did with Greg on consciousness, but with the three of us, because trilogues seem to be really good, by the way. So I'm trying to respond to that. And then the other point you made, the point that concerns me, you're right. And I think some of the stuff I wrote in the email, which we haven't burdened the viewers with, which is good, about how it's making me rethink, especially how symbols work. This has been tremendously helpful. And Chris and I are getting very excited about it. So I wanted to thank this discussion. I couldn't have come up with these points on my own. And so I'm genuinely and sincerely grateful about that. But there's a concern I have, and I've spoken to Mark about it, and I've spoken to a little bit Mary, right? There's a methodology. I have a particular thing I need to do. I need to have this so that people like yourselves who are interested in religiously, spiritually will go, yeah, I can link with that. But I also have to be able to point to the cognitive scientists and go, yeah, yeah, I can agree with that. And so there's a methodology I'm bound to, right? And so I have to be very careful about just adding things in that don't follow that very strict methodology. People can do whatever they want, right? I'm not trying, but what I'm trying to say is, if you're saying, well, we want to add it to this existing thing, it's not really fair to me, right? Because we set up taxonomies for goals. It's not fair to me if you, and I'm not accusing anybody, I'm stating a request. It's not fair to me unless that methodology is also adopted. You can do what you want. You can build other taxonomies, but if you want to add it in, you have to use the same grammar by which the other four Ps were created. And so that's been an ongoing concern of mine. Did that make sense? I mean, it's a request if we add to this taxonomy and the cognitive scientists go, I don't care about that. That doesn't make any sense to me. Then for me, it's lost its functionality.
Right. I think that's exactly, I mean, we're doing what we've been talking about the whole time. We've got these mappings of four things, and what you're doing, John, and what Mary's doing, what I'm doing, I'm hopefully, is what we are saying, okay, well, we've got this little system over here of cognitive science, and we can, I mean, I've watched this happen in theology forever. Oh, we have our Reformed theology, we have our Reformed dogma, our whole system works really nicely together. And then someone comes along and says, yeah, but I've got this in my life, and this doesn't map onto this. And so, you can hang your Reformed dogma. And so what we're doing is we're doing just like the little child with a knife, fork, spoon. We're doing just like the little, multidimensional structures in the brain. We're expanding, we're collapsing. We're doing we're doing all of this as we're doing this here too. So I see it all as part of a whole.
Well, that's great. I mean, and I'm very grateful about that. I'm also cognizant that you and I have been talking for quite a bit. I should let Mary speak. At some point, maybe we would want to talk about, I don't know if we want to do the methodology arguments. That's probably boring for viewers. But I'm very interested in maybe going to the topic that might be, I have a wonder, it's not a suspicion, because that attributes malicious motives to you guys, right? I'm suspicious, that's not quite right. You guys, I think it's fair to say this is where Jonathan is, you deeply care about the symbolic aspect of things. And I think part of why this is happening is you're trying to, and I share this project with you, about trying to ground the symbolic aspect. And Paul, you do a lot about this, criticizing metaphorical truth. And because the problem with what's happened is symbol has become a language that's somewhat dismissive, to my mind, to my hearing at least. When we say, oh, it's symbolic, that's like, well, it's only metaphorically true. And right, and there's nothing really, it's almost like they're saying it's ornamental. And it's not really part. And I take it that what one of the concerns you guys have, and one of the ways we can express Mary's caring, is you want to care about you have a caring about, there's an aspect of reality that is being vouchsafed to you by this symbolic way. Is that, am I reading you guys correctly? Because if it is, I want to be responsible to that, because I agree. I think it's very important.
Well, I think that the symbolic is about levels of reality and how they connect to one another.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right. And it goes all the way down and it goes all the way up.
Yes.
And, you know, that's something like Seville is exploring Persig's idea of different levels of reality and how they're connected. And Jonathan Pageau is talking about it, you know, delving into the early church fathers and how they connect levels of reality and what they see, you know, and all of these things. And, you know, there's the Jungian archetypes and all of that. It's all expressing the reason why there are so many languages of it. And the reason why there are so many different approaches to it is because it's so big.
Yeah.
But it's also real. I mean, there's always a temptation. And I think this is the great scientific temptation, is to get as much out of the way as possible so I don't have to deal with it, so I can do this little thing, which leads to people saying, one of the problems with the scientists is that they're knowing more and more about less and less, right?
Yes.
You know, we want to get it narrowed down. And then out of that narrowing down comes, you know, because of the power of science as expressed in technology, then it gets this authority to dismiss all this other stuff, which is one of the things that's led people into the meaning crisis.
I agree.
I think what we're trying to do is let's get all that other stuff out there. If it connects to the scientific, and there's a scientific way to either explain it or analyze it or something, that's fine. But just, we want to stand. I think one of the things that's happening is we want to stand against the reductionism.
Sure.
Because if we don't, we'll never recapture the meaning.
No, I totally agree. And I mean, you guys have heard arguments. I'm against reductionism. I argue against it. Reductionism is ultimately absurd. It's self-defeating. And I think we're in agreement. And I mean, and that's why JP and I keep having such fruitful discussions. And I like the idea about, you know, the symbolic as the way in which we try to map between ontological levels. I think insofar as you think that symbols are resisting reductionism, I think that's really interesting. I think that's right. And I think the trick, maybe I'll say one thing and then give you guys a chance to close because I should get going. The trick for me is sort of, you know, there's a Scylla and Charybdis here. And one of the reasons why I'm so attracted to deep continuity is Evan Thompson, my friend, idea of deep continuity is it steers between them. Reductionism gets, and the problem with reductionism is to be consistent, you have to say that only the very, very, very bottom level is real and everything else is an illusion. And that's just so deeply problematic. It's just so deeply problematic. If you say, no, there's ontological realness, not just how we think about it, but reality itself, right? But the problem with that, and I can see it in Paul's work, right? The problem with that is if you're not careful, it fractures into dualisms and multiple layerisms that are equally destructive of meaning. And the reason why I'm so attracted to deep continuity is it tries to steer between reductionism and dualism in a powerful way. And so one of the projects I see myself engaged in is trying to get this symbolic world into deep dialogue with deep continuity. Can we understand symbolism in terms of deep continuity? That's why I was so fascinated by what Mary was doing at the beginning. She was invoking deep continuity and then trying to, not sorry, that makes it sound like she failed. She was, right, mapping that symbolically, right? She was mapping it into symbolic activity and behavior. And I think beyond our disagreements, I think that move that Mary made of there's some deep relationship of mutual affordance and mutual support between deep continuity and a way of understanding human symbolic behavior. I think that's deeply right. And I've been trying to argue a similar thing, but I'm not trying to take anything away from Mary either. I'm saying I feel that that's a point of deep convergence between the two of us.
So let me ask you a question. Deep continuity starts at the human and goes down. What if we wanted to have a deep continuity, but we want to go the other direction? What would we call that? What's the opposite of deep?
The problem is it's used both ways, which is unfortunate.
Oh, it goes both directions?
Well, sure.
Okay. Once it goes both directions, then I'm good with it. I just don't want to put us at the top of the mountain.
No. I wouldn't do that. I mean, we probably differ about how deeply up it goes. Although I'm not sure, because I'm a non-theist in certain ways. And I take serious mystical experiences, but at a level I think is becoming relatively non-controversial within cognitive science is you go up from individual cognition to distributed cognition, which I think is, you guys are committed to that. You're committed to the ecclesia having a life of its own above and beyond the individuals. And this is taking, so there's deep continuity between individual cognition and distributed cognition. So that is at least, I wouldn't say everybody totally agrees with that in the world of cognitive science, but that is a deeply respectable move to make. So that's a deep continuity up that I think is widely acknowledged now.
Okay. That's getting somewhere. I like it.
Well, and I think, I watch the reductionism happen, but then there's a whole lot of other smuggling going on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I just want to say, well, where are you getting that from? Because that's not all of this stuff down here. You've scaled up, but you're not saying, oh, by the way, we've just scaled up and we're looking at distributive cognition. So no, and John, you have to, and I know a lot of the explaining you do for the sake of the audience, but you have to understand that you are deeply trusted. I speak for myself by me. I mean, I've never in all of my conversations with you, you're a man of deep integrity and deep care and concern. And so I'm not at all anxious about you in any of these things.
Well, thank you for that. And I appreciate that. That was a gesture of love and I reciprocate it very much to both of you. Don't hold me out as some singular exemplar, right? There are many, many people like me.
Oh yeah.
Right. And so, right, especially within cognitive science, especially within 4E cognitive science. So there's a huge scientific community that is talking this way, at least where there's significant overlap between the three of us, and doing just tremendous. That's why, again, the work of Evan Thompson, like his work is just mind blowing. I just want it to be clear. I understand that I've sort of taken on the role of the voice of cognitive science within the internet, and I'll try and live up to that responsibility as honorably as possible. But I do want people who are like, there's lots of people talking this way, and a lot of, and I know many of them, and they're people of integrity as well. So I just want to make that clear too.
Same for pastors.
Yeah.
Lots of people. You're the only pastor. No, I'm just the one right here on the YouTube channel. There's lots more out there. So we all have our little ecclesias out there functioning, and that's a good thing.
Yeah. And one of the functions of this is to get the ecclesias to talk to each other, hopefully.
Yep.
It's not just us talking. If we're properly humble, right, we are also making those ecclesias present to each other, which I think is an important responsibility that needs to be discussed a little bit more in this corner of the internet, or maybe in the internet as a whole. Yeah. But guys, I should get going. I want to give Mary a chance to say any.
I think everything's been covered. I really appreciate your listening to me, even if anything I expressed was kind of sloppy from the cognitive science perspective.
No, it wasn't.
But I do appreciate it. And I think it's been a great conversation. So maybe we'll just talk through emails about when we're going to speak together and what the topic might be. So
Sure. Like I said, I'm happy to make a part three. Trilogies are really good. It's what we've learned from Lucas is don't go beyond the trilogy, right?
Yeah, but what about the profit motive?
Yeah. Take good care, my friends.
Thank you both.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.